Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't want to die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't want to die, but I'm on my own.
Welcome to the Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast. My name is Haley, and I am one of the co-hosts for the pod. If you're a regular listener, you may already tell that this edit is a bit different than our usual edit. Jillian is still in the process of moving, and so she will be, unfortunately, not be on today. We are so excited for her next chapter of her career, though, so we're wishing her the best of luck from afar until she can come back to her computer. Today we're flying solo, so buckle up, because we are both in for a hell of a ride. Instead of having our beginning chit-chat, I'm just going to jump right in. Today you're going to hear me talk about the Alpine Meadows avalanche that occurred in 1982 in Lake Tahoe, California. A couple months ago, I was searching Netflix and I came across this documentary called Buried, the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche. It's a pretty interesting but tragic documentary. If you're a skier or you live near the Lake Tahoe area, you may find this to be an interesting watch as well. Personally, for me, I am not a cold weather person and avalanches scare me, but I am fascinated with those who recreate in cold weather climates and have to be aware of cold weather events such as avalanches. So, like I said, today we are in Lake Tahoe, California. And this area is within the Sierra Nevada mountain range. We've actually talked about the Sierra Nevadas before on this podcast when we talked about the Donner Party. This is the mountain range where the Donner Party had become stranded in from 1846 to 1847 and ultimately had to resort to cannibalism to survive. Other notable historic events in the Sierra Nevadas include the Gold Rush, I'm sure everybody knows about that, and the Transcontinental Railway. Fun fact about the Transcontinental Railway, I was recently watching a History Channel documentary. It was one of those, like, The Blank That Built America, one of those series. It was either, like, The Titans That Built America or The Machines That Built America. It was one of those episodes on the History Channel. And essentially, long story short, there was a West Coast team and an East Coast team that were responsible to build this railway system. And the West Coast team had only built 690 miles worth of railway, whereas the East Coast team ended up building about a little over 1,000 miles of railway. And so the East Coast team started in Nebraska, and by the time that they got to Utah, the West Coast team had finally broken through the Sierra Nevadas. So it took the West Coast team a long, long time to build this railway on their end of the United States because they had to break through the granite of the Sierra Nevadas, and that is a very, very, very hard rock, so it took them a long time to get through there. So I just thought that was a little fun fact, and I had recently watched that documentary, so I thought that was interesting. But anyway, the Sierra Nevadas run 400 miles north to south, and its width ranges from 50 miles to 80 miles across east to west. Notable features include General Sherman, which is the largest tree in the world by volume. We have Lake Tahoe, the largest alpine lake in North America, Mount Whitney at 14,505 feet, also known as a 14er, to the hiking community. Mount Whitney is also the highest point in the contiguous United States. And Yosemite Valley, which is sculpted by glaciers from 100 million-year-old granite containing high waterfalls. The Sierra is home to 3 national parks, 26 wilderness areas, 10 national forests, and 2 national monuments. These areas include Yosemite, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and Devil's Postpile National Monument. Alpine Meadows sits in the northwest corner of Lake Tahoe, and according to Lanny Johnson, who was on the ski patrol team at Alpine Meadows, he says, "There is no place in the world related to avalanche hazard that is more dangerous than Alpine Meadows." Alpine Meadows was recognized as one of the highest avalanche areas in the country and was rated a Class A, which is the highest class. Larry Haywood, who was the Alpine Meadows Assistant Patrol Director, recalls it being more of an A++ place. Larry says that it was just this kind of wonderful little avalanche machine. Just down the road from Alpine Meadows is Squaw Valley, where they had the 1960 Winter Olympics. At Squaw Valley, there's a dress code, and it sounds like it might be a little bit more stuffy over there, like a lot of rich people. Versus the Alpine Meadows crew and community, where there was more of a work hard, play hard attitude. The staff at Alpine Meadows, the ski patrol team members, and the lift operators, they're all friends with each other. They hang out outside of work, and they even rented a bus and went down to Reno to see the Grateful Dead one time. Now, Alpine is not the biggest mountain, but it is wall-to-wall riddled with avalanche paths. But it is possible to stay ahead of the avalanches, and that's why there are avalanche forecasters. Avalanches occur as layers in a snowpack slide off. So these snow layers build up over time, create weak points, and as more weight is added, those weak points fail and a sheet of snow slides off the mountain. At Alpine Meadows, there is a lot of wind-driven snow, so the ridgetop is perpendicular to the westerly flow of the storms, so it acts as a giant snow fence. The wind that comes roaring up the valley that's to the west of Alpine picks snow up off the slopes that are facing the wind and then deposits it on the lee slopes, which is right at Alpine Meadows. The terrain at Alpine Meadows is sort of a steep kind of terrain, right from the top to the base. On top of that, this location has a lot of fluctuating temperatures, so you get different layers. You'll have a light layer of snow and then a heavy layer of snow, and then a light layer of snow and then a heavy layer of snow, which in turn creates a weak scenario. So again, what an avalanche is essentially one of these layers fails, and when that occurs, a whole entire sheet of snow breaks loose. Alpine was pretty unique. Alpine was particularly unique because every ski lift could be impacted by an avalanche. The access road, parking lot, and the whole base of the resort is also affected by avalanches, and you might want to keep that information in mind for later. Back in the 80s and even before then, there were only a handful of avalanche experts. Monty Atwater, who is known as the father of avalanche control, Norm Wilson, who was the protege of Monty Atwater, and then Jim Plain, who was the mentee of Norm Wilson. Monty Atwater was at Squaw in the Olympics and came to Alpine in the late 50s when it was being built. He recognized right away that this is one hell of an avalanche kind of place. So, how exactly do you control an avalanche? Well, the most known way that ski patrol areas provide avalanche control is through explosives. In 1982, they were using a gelatin dynamite. They would throw it on the known starting zone of the avalanche path, which Alpine had about 300 of these starting zones. They'd get into a safe location, pull the hand charger out, and then they would light it, and then they would throw these explosives on the starting zone. Essentially, they would be purposefully creating avalanches at the time of their choosing when nobody was on the slopes. They would do this every morning so the big avalanches never built up. Imagine that as your job. You're going to a mountain every morning and just using dynamite to blow these snow layers up. I think that's pretty neat. Another way the ski patrol would try to set off avalanches is by what they call ski cutting, which is when the ski patrol members ski perpendicular across the mountain along these starting zones in hopes of setting off an avalanche with their skis. But that doesn't seem to be as fun as blowing things up, right? Also, it seems more dangerous, like you could actually get yourself buried if you did set one off. But there is a third way to induce an avalanche, and this is a pretty unique way. And it's only unique to a few ski areas as well. And this is through the use of military artillery. By using the same bullets that were used in wartime to kill people, they'd set off avalanches. But how the heck did they think of this, right? Monty Atwater, do you remember him, the father of avalanche control? Well, he was a member of the 10th Mountain Division. He knew about and he also saw avalanches be used as a weapon of war. They were being shot down by artillery on enemy troops. When Monty got out of the war, one of the big things that he did was bring artillery to ski resorts. So this allows you to hit targets high on a mountain from a safe distance. This method was one of the crucial methods that Alpine Meadows used in their avalanche prevention techniques. This method also allows you to do avalanche control in inclement weather. Larry Haywood, the assistant director of ski patrol at Alpine Meadows, says that for Alpine, without the use of artillery, well, it just wouldn't survive. The buildings wouldn't be there. So by now, you can understand that Alpine Meadows is accustomed to avalanches, and it is a very avalanche-prone area. There have been avalanches before this 1982 avalanche, and there have been avalanches after this 1982 avalanche. In 1976, three people died in an avalanche in what was called Beaver Bowl, which is a part of Alpine Meadows ski path. The patrolman who did the avalanche control work recommended it be kept closed, but he was overridden by Bernie Kingery, who was the Alpine Meadows mountain manager. This event nearly destroyed Bernie as a human being, but he stood up and said, "Hey, I need help." So that is when Jim Plain got hired. Jim was about 27, and he had already seen what the mountain could do, and he was quite honestly intimidated by it, but he also felt very honored that Bernie would call him up to help. So remember, Jim Plain was a mentee of Norm Wilson, and Norm Wilson was the protege of Monty Atwater, who was the father of avalanche control. So Jim was 27 when he was hired at Alpine Meadows. The avalanche control program, which is also part of the ski patrol, the avalanche control program started in 1960 and became more and more refined over the years. When Jim started on the ski patrol at Alpine Meadows, the program was still fairly young, and it was run by Jim's mentor and great friend, Norm Wilson. He quickly realized there was a lot of work to do. They had to develop a way to keep track of over 300 starting zones for avalanches. And in comparison, Vail, Colorado only had a few slopes that they had to deal with. The structure was a three-way partnership with Bernie Kingery, who was the mountain manager at the top, and then Jim Plain, the avalanche forecaster, and Bob Blair, the ski patrol director at the bottom. So imagine a triangle with Bernie at the top, and then Jim and Bob on the sides beneath Bernie. So Jim had developed a snowpack observation program that was certainly cutting edge for its time. Remember, this is like in the late 70s, before computers. He developed route sheets that listed all of the shot placements, the maximum vertical fall of the avalanche path, type of avalanche, size of avalanche, depth of fracture, and release mechanism, which is, was it an explosive or did they do it by the ski cutting? What mechanism was used to release this avalanche? Specific descriptions and game plans is what Jim worked on, and he worked really hard to develop a program at Alpine and through his team, make it the best that it could be. So now flash forward, we're in 1982, and at this time, Jim has about 7 years of forecasting under his belt. So he was feeling pretty on top of his game. But by the afternoon on March 31st, 1982, he would feel as if he hit rock bottom. On March 31st, 1982, a terrible tragedy occurred at Alpine Meadows Ski Resort. Let's get into it. Jim wakes up in the morning a few days prior to March 31st and sees this big storm has started. And then he thinks to himself, "Oh boy, we are going to be in for it." The Forest Service said on the news back then that they have never had this much snow in the Sierras this late in the year. Mike Alves, who was the heavy equipment manager of Alpine Meadows, says he believes they got 11 feet of snow in 7 days. Lanny Johnson, who was a ski patrol member, says that they had to keep purging the storm. If they kept purging the storm, they wouldn't get that massive release. Meaning, if they kept causing smaller avalanches through their control work, they wouldn't get a massive avalanche. That was the hope, anyway. Tom Kimbrough and Lanny Johnson, both members of the ski patrol team, went out and shot their way down the mountain. They were both really excited to go out in 100-mile winds with, quote, a bunch of bombs on their back. But in a short amount of time, the snow from the storm had changed the terrain features on the mountain so much that it was like going into the unknown for them. Lanny recalls the cornice, which are essentially overhanging edges of snow, were huge, and the buildups on the ridge were massive. As they came down the Beaver Estelle Ridge, they were skiing in powder that was up to their chest, and they almost couldn't even move downhill. They got to the base where they'd hiked to Poma Rocks, but they started to realize that the breaking of the trail was futile. They essentially could not walk or ski in chest-deep snow. So Lanny says to Tom, quote, "I feel like there's a dragon underneath this snow." So they made the decision to descend down to the summit building to regroup. They knew that they couldn't make it to Poma Rocks, which Lanny recalls as later being very emotionally difficult for him and Tom to deal with, because they thought maybe, just maybe, if they could have made it to Poma Rocks, things would have been a little bit different. Meredith Watson, who was the only female ski patrol team member, recalls that during storm periods, the ski patrol team would put a few people on the top of the mountain at a lift shack so they could shoot in the morning before running patrol up the lift. And when they say shoot, they mean blow things up. They'd go up at 3 or 4 p.m. the night before. Wilson and Billy, who are also ski patrol members, each had a case of dynamite, and Meredith had a cardboard box full of food. The impression she had was that they were just going to stay overnight. She remembers what she calls quote-unquote violence racking the shack. Wind was howling and the weather was just horrible up there. The night of March 30th, the winds really ramped up, and Jim says that he will never forget the morning of the 31st, waking up and seeing snow coming in sideways with wind sounding like a jet engine. Can you imagine? So at 5 a.m. on March 31st, there's 87 inches of new snow. Jim gets up and he goes to the patrol room, and Bernie is already there. The patrol office is also known as the Summit Terminal Building, and that is the main lift at Alpine Meadows. The base of it was all housed in this big building, and it's this big A-frame type of building. In this building were also various locker rooms for all of the crews that worked at Alpine Meadows. When Jim looked at the chart recorder for the wind, he saw that it had been pegged many times during the night at the maximum reading of 120 miles per hour. He even says that the chart had been dripping red ink because the needle had been swinging back and forth so aggressively. Bernie got on the phone to call the general manager, Howard Carnell, to inform him that they did not think that they should open Alpine Meadows that day. The manager of the condo complex up the way, though, had gone to the ski resort to talk to Bernie, and Bernie told that manager of the condo complex to go back home and do not let anybody leave because it is too dangerous outside. Jim and Bernie made the decision to not open Alpine Meadows Ski Resort on March 31st, 1982. That morning, Sandy Harris, a lift operator, had also gotten up to go to work along with her friends, Anna Conrad and Beth Morrow, as they were both scheduled to work that day. Anna Conrad was a lift operator. Sandy says that they were not born sisters, but they were made sisters. Anna's boyfriend Frank Yateman was visiting her from UC Davis for spring break. So when they found out that they weren't going to work that day because the mountain had been closed, they all headed back into the house to hang out. Except Beth. Beth was also a lift operator and decided that she wanted to go on up. Sandy recalls her personality as being more introspective and quieter. Jim notes that although she was part of the lift crew, she really wanted to be involved with the ski patrol, which is why she went up to help out at the summit building. Sandy kept pushing on Beth to come back inside, not as if it was a premonition that was provoking her, but more of a friend just wanting to care for another friend, saying like, hey, just come back on inside and like hang out with us. Like, don't go out there. Just have fun with us today, you know? But Beth went on up the mountain. The Forest Service Snow Rangers had come in to fire the artillery in hopes of preventing an avalanche by ultimately causing an avalanche. Again, that's what this avalanche control work is. They're essentially creating smaller avalanches to maintain to prevent a larger avalanche from building up. Don Heber was one of these snow rangers. Bob Moore was another one of these snow rangers. Jim recalls firing twice the normal amount of rounds. Visibility was terrible, so they weren't certain of what they were looking at. They thought that they saw avalanche debris, which in hindsight gave them a false sense of security. And as a result, they did not feel like they had to block off the parking lot to keep people out of that zone. Meredith and Billy and Wilson were directed to go out and shoot Ward Peak. She says it was very low visibility, and the wind was so high that the physical movement of snowflakes hitting the ridge so hard that there was all of this friction that built up like static electricity. Meredith recalls throwing bombs over the cornice, and at one point, there was a spark, at least a foot long, she says, and it just appeared out of nowhere. Because remember, the static electricity? I imagine static electricity and bombs don't mix well together. So Meredith dropped the bomb and looked at Billy, and they both said, "Well, we have to get out of here." They secured the pack in a place where it wouldn't get buried and abandoned it. Then they made their way back to the shack. It's now 2:55 p.m., and some of the crew needs to go do avalanche control on the Alpine Meadows Road. So how do you do this? Larry Haywood states that you drive over to Squaw Valley and then ride up the KT-22 lift. Then there's about 4 to 5 people that are going to close the Alpine Meadows Road in certain sections and guard it and sweep it. This is to keep people off of the road and safe if the team were to cause an avalanche during their control work. Jeffrey Smith, aka Jake, was part of the Alpine Meadows trail crew and assigned to be the upper road guard. Everyone remembers him as being just a wonderful person who was always pulling pranks and upbeat attitude and funny. As Jim and his team are about to leave to go drive to Squaw Valley, they saw two skiers approach them. Well, who could that be? Because everybody's not supposed to be out and about, right? Well, it was Anna Conrad and her boyfriend Frank. But wait, I thought they were safely inside of their house with Sandy. Well, you know, that's true, but Sandy recalls Frank getting a bit stir-crazy about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so they just went out to do a little cross-country skiing up the road. Jim sees these two, and he ends up chewing Anna out as she was one of the people who were told not to go to work that day. He told her that it was too dangerous to be out and that her and Frank should head up to the lodge and stay there until Jim and his crew were done patrolling and controlling for avalanches. So now it's 3:15 p.m. and there's 103 inches of new snow on the ground. As Jim was driving down the road, he said that you could see snow cascading off of the banks. He says that you could hear a crackling or a tinkling in the snow and that it all felt electric, much like that static electricity that Meredith talked about, right? Jim says that electricness was something that they had never seen before, and the feeling of impending doom was impossible to ignore. Now it's 3:38 p.m., so Lanny Johnson, who is on the ski patrol team, had the day off, but his gut tells him to call in and check on the crew. So when he called, Bernie Kingery, the mountain manager, answered the phone. Lanny recalls him and Bernie having, quote-unquote, quite the conversation of what had slid and what hadn't slid. At one point in the conversation, Bernie tells Lanny to hold on, and he could hear Bernie tearing into Anna Conrad about disobeying the stay-at-home order, just like Jim did. Then Bernie said again, hold on, and then Lanny waits, and the phone goes dead. Lanny didn't know what happened at the time, but Sandy recalls that about 3:40 p.m. the lights flickered. A few minutes later, Sandy's phone rang, and it was her friend Jennifer. And Jennifer said, Sandy, is that you? Sandy replies, yeah, what's going on? And then Jennifer says back, thank God you answered the phone. So, clearly, Sandy's catching some news of what's going on right now. As Jim and his crew gets to the lift in Squaw Valley, he hears fragments of a radio conversation. That person that he heard on the other end was Howard Carnell, the GM of Alpine Meadows Resort. In between the static of the radio, Jim heard Howard say, what? What happened? Well, call Don Huber. Get the dogs. And Jim could tell through the static that it wasn't good. They immediately try to reach Bernie, but he doesn't answer the phone. Jim says, Bob Blair's at home. Let's call him. So they call Bob Blair, and they ask what's going on over at Alpine Meadows. Bob Blair says, I don't know for sure, but you need to get back there right now. Now Meredith is getting a phone call. Remember, her and her team are at the top of the mountain in a lift shack? When Meredith picks up the phone, it's Karen Strohmeyer screaming on the other end of the phone. and it took Merida some time to calm her down, but eventually she relays the information. As Jim and his crew are driving back to Alpine Meadows, they're passing houses and cars of people that have shovels ready to help. As Jim and his crew are driving back to Alpine Meadows, they're passing cars of people that have shovels that are ready to help. Somehow, within minutes, word got out that there had been an avalanche at Alpine Meadows and they needed help. A lot of help. Troy Caldwell, longtime resident of Alpine Meadows, recalls that the roads were so messed up that they started to use snowcats to get things going. As Jim and Larry and the crew are approaching Alpine Meadows parking lot, they realize that the building in which Bernie, Beth, Anna, and Frank were in is now gone. The frame of the building is still standing, but the windows, sides, and roof are all busted in, with a whole pile of snow inside. Larry recalls the lockers, wood, supplies, you name it. It was all strewn about for about a half of a football field. Jeff Scover, an employee and survivor of the avalanche, recalls from his hospital bed that Bernie was just a few steps away from him and Beth had been sitting in a chair across from him. They were in the patrol office when they heard Jake over the radio yell, "Avalanche!" Bernie grabbed the microphone and said, "Where?" And he got no response. Jeffrey Smith, aka Jake, was the first casualty of the Alpine Meadows avalanche. He tried to outrun the avalanche on his snowmobile, but unfortunately could not outpace the stampede of snow that was rolling behind him. Randy Buck, an employee and also survivor, sitting next to Jeff Scover in their hospital beds, recalls that the building started to shake about 1 foot either way. They both recall that it was the most horrifying sound that they had ever heard. The next thing that had happened was an air blast that hit the building before the snow. The whole wall had been blasted out, and these survivors, Jeff and Randy, watched Bernie and Beth get blown out with it. Talk about traumatizing. The only reason that Jeff and Randy survived is that there was a big, massive counterweight that diverted the air blast and the snow around them. Larry and Jim had heard that Anna and her boyfriend Frank were in the back room of the same building that got blasted away. The stories continued throughout the parking lot as well. Mike Alves, the heavy equipment manager for Alpine Meadows, was standing out in the parking lot and saw three figures walking towards him, two adults and a younger person. Three people from the condos had gotten cabin fever and wanted to get out and go for a walk, much like Anna and Frank did. Unfortunately, there was no gate blocking off this area because remember how earlier I said that they had some false sense of security because they thought that they saw avalanche debris when they had shot over on the mountain near the parking lot? So because of that false sense of security, they did not block the parking lot off with proper signage. Remember that. Unfortunately, there was no gate blocking this area off. A noise caught Mike's attention, and he's quoted saying that it sounded like snapping twigs, and it probably lasted somewhere between 3 to 5 seconds. Those three people, he says, got swept away. So slowly, the ski patrol crews are piecing together these stories, and after the avalanche, they've concluded that there were 8 people missing and presumably buried. They are Jake Smith, Bernie Kingery, Beth Morrow, David Hahn, Bud Nelson, Laura Nelson, Frank Yateman, and Anna Conrad. Jim was understandably in shock. After all, he was the avalanche forecaster. Did he miss something here? Was it all his fault? These thoughts ran through his head. Like I said, he felt as if he was on the top of his game, and then within a matter of days, he had felt as if he hit rock bottom. Larry has now turned from assistant director to accident site commander. His job was to get people organized and probe lines going. They used machines, shovels, and chainsaws. Essentially, they needed to somehow strategically tear into the building to look for people. Time was of the essence. Larry states that your survival in an avalanche is really low, and it's about 30 minutes or so. So there's a lot of volunteers that came to help, and these are your local residents who may or may not have experience with probe lines. They were getting a quick rundown of how to use probe lines, and it's quoted that they were told to do a couple of pokes in the snow, and there will be a special feel on the end of your probe when you've hit a body. Everyone was doing the best that they could with very minimal equipment. All of the emergency avalanche equipment that had been kept at Alpine Meadows lived in that building that got blasted away, so now it's all gone and buried. Back at the lift shack, Meredith and her team were sitting on top of the mountain with a rescue cache. They had about 40 probe poles and shovels, but were told to stay put. Everyone that was told to stay put were starting to get frustrated because they didn't exactly know what happened. They were just being told to stay in place. And they're like, why? Why am I staying in place? And Meredith is quoted asking, do you risk three people's lives to bring more equipment down to the bottom? What's the right answer to that? Because clearly something happened and they probably need more equipment, right? Around 5 p.m., the avalanche search dogs show up. Roberta Huber is the avalanche rescue dog owner, along with her husband, Don. And they both searched the lower parking lot with their dogs, but they didn't find anything. During this time, it's also in the infancy of utilizing dogs for avalanche rescues. So this created a little bit of a speed bump in the rescue process because these dogs were finding people's lunches and mice during their search. They weren't necessarily trained for an avalanche rescue to the caliber that they are probably trained at today. Lanny Johnson, who is a ski patrol member, remember he had the day off, he decided to show up and turn his beacon on and start walking around in hopes of finding a signal. Casey Jones, who is also on the ski patrol team, walked past Lanny, and Lanny said to Casey, hey Casey, do you have your beacon on? And Casey replied, yes. So Lanny decided to turn his beacon off because clearly there was some interference with the beacons being utilized by the rescuers. So there was also another speed bump in the rescue efforts with the beacons as well. Lanny later realizes that when he had this conversation with Casey, he was standing right on top of Beth Morrow, one of the Alpine Meadows lift operators who had been swept away in the main lodge building. Larry and other rescuers find a mangled snowmobile, partially buried, and they know that it's Jake. Bob Blair looks at Casey Jones and says, go find Jake. So they go to where they know Jake should be, and they get a beacon signal right away. Jake was recovered by his friends and fellow ski patrolmen. His body was contorted, broken, and frozen. The two men that were in the parking lot had also been found the same night that Jake was found. So to recap, the following are still missing. Bernie Kingery, Beth Morrow, Laura Nelson, Frank Yateman, and Anna Conrad. As the rescue team starts to recover the bodies, they move them into the first aid room, and everyone is still really rattled by nightfall. Everyone is still wondering what happened to their leader, Bernie Kingery, you know, the mountain man manager. Bob and Jim were the last few people to leave the resort that night. They loaded up a snowcat with the bodies that had been rescued and took them down to the coroner. So now it's nightfall, and Sandy, who is still at home, is still left in the dark about what happened. But also, well, she's still left in the dark about what happened to her friends, too. So she finally gets a hold of Casey, and he tells her that they know Anna, Frank, Bernie, and Beth were in the building that got blasted away. And he says to her, get yourself ready for this, because no one is walking away from it. Sandy starts to pray, just please, please let just one of them walk away. Meredith is still on top of the mountain and can't sleep. She recalls it at 2 a.m., the moon is just mocking her because it's so calm and bright out, almost as if Mother Nature was like, see? See what I can do? The next day, the press showed up. So now it's April 1st. Jim and his crew hired a helicopter to help them manage the avalanche. They were going to fly up and over the mountain to get an aerial view of the avalanche starting zones. Then they dynamite those zones, hoping to clear up any more avalanche risk and get more rescuers safely into Alpine Meadows. The only thing is, when they saw the helicopter, it was a Channel 3 helicopter. Yep, that's right, it was a Sacramento News Station helicopter. So they had to change their plan a bit by taking the doors off of the helicopter and removing all of the camera equipment from the back. They were still able to utilize the helicopter for their needs, though. When they went up and analyzed the mountain, they were stunned at what they saw. They realized that there was still a lot of hazard on the mountain. The avalanche had taken out what would normally be four separate avalanche areas. These four areas linked together created one massive slide. the exact type of massive slide they were trying to prevent by always doing these mini avalanches. Jim recalls the fracture lines being really big, shocking, and alarming. Jim declares that their control work was not effective due to the size of the avalanche, which is why he got so cautious during the rescue. Now all of a sudden, he has a lot more people to worry about. Lanny recounts that they would fly and fly and bomb and bomb. Lanny sat up front and would tell Jim in the back when to throw. They shot all over the slopes and didn't get great results. By mid-morning, the 120 rescue search team that was made up of ski patrol and volunteer members could resume searching for the five remaining missing people. They found the third missing person in the parking lot that day, along with Beth inside of the remnants of the building. So, to continue recapping, here are the remaining people that are missing. Bernie Kingery, who is the mountain manager, Frank Yateman, who is the boyfriend of Anna Conrad, who was a lift operator, and Anna Conrad, who is a lift operator. Bernie Kingery, mountain manager, Anna Conrad, lift operator, and Frank Yateman, the boyfriend of Anna Conrad. And just to also remind you guys, these three people were in the same building as Beth Morrow. And she was found. So they're, at this point, they're all staying in the same area of the resort. They're all focusing their search around this building at this point. Lanny describes continuing his search around the building, just kind of like digging along, when he notices this fuzzy thing. All of a sudden, he realizes, holy cow, that's Frank Yateman. This is his head. That's the back of a human head. Lanny understandably has a massive surge of anxiety. Frank was crushed up against one of those old-time electric heaters. He had lost the contents of his stomach, and when they pulled him away, that's when Lanny had what he calls, quote-unquote, FaceTime. Lanny goes on to give the advice of minimizing FaceTime if you want to minimize PTSD in scenarios like this. He recalls Frank's face frozen in a horrified position. Lanny somehow manages to compartmentalize his anxiety and trauma to continue searching for Anna and Bernie. Lanny thought to himself, where's Anna? I found Frank. Anna has to be nearby. So that night, Lanny was yelling into the snow for her, saying, Anna, Anna, we're here. Anna, we're coming to get you. 2 days after the avalanche, Anna and Bernie are still buried somewhere. Dogs are still working, but again, the problem with the dogs is that they were alerting everywhere. There's human debris all over the place, like socks and lunches and shoes, you name it. People's belongings were still strewn about. Roberta, the dog rescue trainer, spent most of the day searching outside the building when all of a sudden her dog, Bridget, ran into a small, dark, triangular hole. Then she came out and was bouncing all around, alerting that she found something. And Roberta thought that from Bridget's demeanor that Anna was alive. Keep in mind, this whole time during the rescue efforts, this snowstorm has still been actively impacting the area. So by the afternoon on the second day of rescue, things were rapidly getting out of hand with the weather, and they were just about to call the search off when Roberta told Jim that she thinks Bridget, the dog, has located one of the victims, and Roberta told Jim that she's 99% sure Anna is alive. And let me just backtrack and say, when I say they were just about to call the search off, that wasn't like an indefinite calling the search off. That was just for the day, since the weather was getting worse. It was probably going to be about 15 feet to dig down to the locker room, and it was going to take some considerable amount of time to get to Anna. Then the storm ramped up. So now Jim has a decision to make, and he is torn. Do we keep digging to try to get Anna out, or do we call the search off for the day to keep everybody else safe? His training is screaming at him, like, you have to protect the rescuers. So he made what was the most difficult decision of his life, and he called off the search. He asks to board up the hole and hope to get there as soon as possible the next morning. Unfortunately, the next morning, Saturday, April 3rd, they woke to blizzard conditions, and now there's 133 inches of new snow on the ground and that is 11 feet. They were unable to do any rescue work that day. Some people took the day off and just went to Jake's funeral, but nobody was doing any rescue work on Saturday, April 3rd, and Anna was still stuck in her hole. So Bernie and Anna have a day lost of rescue. Sunday, April 4th, there was 149 inches of new snow. So again, no rescue work that day. And yet another day that passes where Anna and Bernie are still buried. Finally, on Monday, April 5th, the weather cleared and rescue efforts resumed. Bridget wasn't fooling around, though. She went right to that hole that they had left off at. Meredith and her crew were down to one carton of milk between the three of them. Since the weather was clear for a while, it was their little window of opportunity to get off of the mountain by helicopter. They were assigned right away to work on the building. But the weather was coming in strong again, so her and Lanny were hustling. Lanny pulls back this piece of plywood, and out comes this hand, and Meredith yells, "Whoa, did you see that?" Everybody was in shock. Anna Conrad was alive. Anna was on the second floor of the Summit Terminal building, walking towards her boyfriend, Frank, who was placed at the very end of the hall. All of a sudden, she had lost all awareness. Everything went black. When she woke up, she was in a black hole and couldn't see anything. She wasn't pinned, but she couldn't stretch out, and her head pounded with a serious concussion. She didn't seem to be hurt anywhere else, but it hurt her to move because her head hurt so much. And she recalls being woken up the second day by avalanche blasts. So she starts trying to piece things together in her head, and she knows that she's at Alpine Meadows. She thinks that one of these avalanche bombs must have gone off and something bad happened. And then she starts to get sick. She hasn't had anything to eat or drink. There was some snow around her and she was cold. She tried her might to stay warm, and she could hear people yelling from her name from above her, and she would try to yell herself back to them, but she would yell herself hoarse trying to get them to hear her. Because of her concussion, though, she didn't remember that her boyfriend, Frank, was with her. She also did not remember that she had seen Bernie and Beth minutes before all of this happened, which, to me, that is a blessing in disguise. She never had an inkling that they were even dead. She just knew she wanted to get out alive so she could tell all of her friends and family how much that she loved them. Being alone with her thoughts for so long had made her realize she may not have been the most communicative about her emotions in the past, and she wanted to make a change. So again, a blessing in disguise that her concussion made her forget who she was with the day of the avalanche. On Monday, when she woke up, she thought, "Oh God, I really hope that they can get to me today because I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to be conscious. I am starting to get really, really sick." In fact, when the rescuers pulled the last board out from her and the snow fell into that hole, the fact that she saw snow fall at all was that all that she could think about, which is why she grabbed for the snow, allowing Meredith and Lanny to see her hand move out from that hole, knowing that she's alive. Word spread pretty quick that someone had been found alive, and everybody was so excited. They're cheering. It was a very, very happy moment. A miracle had occurred. After days of sadness, frustration, pain, and anxiety, they were relieved for a moment by finding Anna alive. What happened to Frank was her first question, which was met with a, "Who's Frank?" The rescuers knew who Frank was, but it wasn't the time to tell her that her boyfriend did not survive the avalanche. It was the early days of care flights, but Anna was airlifted to the hospital. Her parents met her there, hugged her, and kissed her, and then asked her dad, "Dad, what happened to Frank? They won't tell me." Through teary eyes, her dad told her that her boyfriend, Frank Yateman, did not survive the avalanche. Anna recalls being too sick to cry. She felt heartbroken, but physically she was too broken, hurt, and sick to cry. Bernie Kingery was the last to be found, almost like the captain going down with his ship, his fist frozen in a fighting stance. When the rescue was all over and done, Jim broke down, along with many of the other Alpine Meadows staff members who have witnessed the horrific aftermath of the avalanche that took the lives of their friends. Meanwhile, Anna is recovering in the hospital. She was touch and go for about 2 weeks. Her and her family would tell the press that she was recovering fine, but there were some nights that they weren't sure if she was going to make it through the night. Her kidneys and liver were close to failing. Her feet had been so frostbitten that the doctors were trying to save them, and she recalled her toes looking like raisins. No one in the hospital let her watch the news because, for one, she was on it every day, but then also they did not want her realizing how bad the avalanche actually was, and they did not want her having a mental breakdown. A lot of these rescuers talk about how they suffered PTSD from this event. Larry, Jim, Lanny, Casey, they all had trouble mentally recovering from what they had endured. Mike Alvis talks about how he has survivor's remorse, and he's quoted saying, "How come those people 40 to 50 feet away from me got hit, but not me?" When the dust settled, a lawsuit came. The two men and the daughter that died in the parking lot, their family sued the Alpine Meadows Ski Resort for negligence. The attorney for the family states that they were innocents. They had gone there to recreate and have fun, and it turned out to be deadly. Remember how I mentioned that the ski patrol staff didn't close the parking lot? This is why I told you to remember that little tidbit of information. Because Bernie had died in the avalanche, the responsibility for representing the company fell onto Jim. And I know I didn't give much of a background on Jim's personality, but he's a bit of an introvert. Jim Plain holds the record in Placer County for the longest time spent on the witness stand ever. To this day, that record is 11 days. At the end of the day, the jury saw that no Alpine Meadows staff, Bob Blair, Bernie Kingery, Jim Plains, the ski area, nobody screwed up. This was simply an act of God. Jim left the ski area the following winter and now works in construction. Jim developed a state-of-the-art avalanche program on his own that is still the core of the Alpine Meadows Avalanche Control Program 30-plus years later. To remember Jake Smith, there's a peak named after him in Alpine Meadows. And Anna has survived, but ended up losing her leg. She underwent surgery to amputate her leg in May of 1982. Her college graduation was in June of 1982, and she was determined to walk at her college graduation 1 month later. She was back skiing by December 1982. She was named Queen of the Handicapped Skiing Championships at Alpine Meadows the same year. Meredith uses Anna Conrad's resilience as a role model for her life now. And then Sandy mentions how she's learned that even there's two sides to everything, good and bad, even in the most traumatizing events. So that is the story of the Lake Tahoe avalanche that occurred in 1982. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I apologize if it was a bit stumbly. I am a bit new to doing this solo, but I hope that you enjoyed that. And again, that was from the documentary Buried, the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche. That's on Netflix. You guys can go on Netflix and watch that. You could also Google this and find multiple articles on it. The background of the Sierra Nevadas that I read about, I just pulled from Wikipedia. Those are my sources. But yeah, I don't even know if we should do a happy thing because we're all on our lonesome. But I suppose my happy thing could be that I'm getting a lot of house projects done in my downtime. So there's that. But yeah. There's also not going to be a conservation corner today just because my throat is already raw from reading for about an hour straight. So I apologize for that if that's what you were looking for or looking forward to. So sorry. I'll do one next time though. Promise. In terms of where you guys can find us on online anywhere, we do have a website. It's called MotherNatureWillKillYouPodcast.com. You can find us on any streaming platform for listening to us. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. Social media. We have a couple social media platforms, which I need to get back on my TikTok game. I'm hopefully going to be doing that this week at some point. But our Instagram is Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast. Our Facebook is Mother Nature Will Kill You. Our TikTok is MNWKY Podcast. And I believe those are the three social medias we have. Cool. Well, until next time, friends, I guess this is where we sign off. So, until next time, friends, stay safe, but most of all, stay curious, explorers. That was weird that I had to do that all by myself, but we did it. And now we go get some wine. Okay, bye.